You're listening to a podcast from the RSA. You can find out more about RSA events and projects and how to get involved with the fellowship by visiting our website, thersa.org.
Good afternoon, everyone. I'm Rowan Conway. I'm Director of Research and Innovation here at the RSA. Welcome to today's lunchtime talk. It's my great pleasure to introduce today's afternoon guest speaker, Beth Simone Novak. Beth is a Jerry Holton Global Network Professor at the New York University and a visiting professor at the MIT Media Lab. Beth served in the White House as the first United States Deputy Chief Technology Officer and was director of the White House Open Government Initiative during the Obama-Biden transition. She is founder and director of the Governance Lab, which aims to improve people's lives by changing how we govern using advances in technology and science. The GovLab designs and tests technology, policy and strategies for fostering more open and collaborative approaches to strengthen the ability of people and institutions to work together, which is a very strong passion of mine as well. It looks at how people can work together to solve problems, make decisions, resolve conflict, and govern themselves more effectively and legitimately. Beth has served as an advisor to the Open Government to David Cameron in the UK as well, so she's crossed both continents, and currently works with a variety of international, local, and national institutions around the world. Her work draws on the way that technology has revolutionised and democratised so much of public life. Despite efforts, polls indicate that there's still a deep distrust of institutions that seems to have left the people in the, out of the governing equation. So Beth will talk to that today. The questions we will ask today are, can public decision-making be more effective and legitimate if our institutions knew how to use technology to embrace citizens' expertise? And what does participatory democracy really look like? And what does it mean? Are we really closer to achieving a more collaborative institutional relationship with the state? So with that, I will hand straight over to Beth. So please join me in welcoming Beth Simone Novak.
Thank you very much. It's really a pleasure to be here, and I appreciate those of you who have given up your lunch hour and those of you who are watching remotely who are eating lunch. So that gives me therefore I want to introduce this by saying I will cause you hopefully no indigestion because I'm here not to talk about politics, and I'm not here to talk about elections, though we are in the midst of one in the United States, as you know. I'm here to talk about what happens the day after the election, when whoever is elected has the responsibility for governing and governing well and solving the challenges that we face. Now, one of those challenges, of course, that you are in the midst of and that seems to be gripping the imagination and the political mindset here is the question of the future of Europe. And this is a question that Jürgen Habermas, the well-known participatory and deliberative democratic theorist that most of us had to read in school, is very obsessed with right now. And he is deeply critical of the European project for the failure to make it more democratically legitimate, for the failing to create institutions that are truly participatory and that generally reflect the will of the people, in favor of technocratic institutions that govern behind closed doors, to the end of achieving better outcomes. But I would like to suggest to you and hopefully show today a few of the ways in which Habermas is wrong, in the following sense. Participatory Democrats like him tend to view there a distinction between technocracy, in other words, effective outcomes and good decisions and problems solved, with legitimate participatory democratic institutions, citizen engagement to the end of asking people how they feel in order to make government more legitimate, if you will. But here is the problem with this. The problem that I put to you is that, number one, the absence of democratic participation does not make institutions more legitimate, does not make them more effective. And he cites, of course, the Greek debt crisis, and we have similar problems in the United States as well, that where we take away democratic participation, it's no guarantee of legitimacy or effectiveness. But what he misses is the fact that actually participation does not have to be about simply asking people how they feel, simply building legitimacy, but can be a way to make government more effective. And let me start by giving you one example from the US and one from the UK of two similar projects where participation is actually helping to solve real problems, in this case to save real lives. So the fire department of San Ramon, California, created an app called Pulse Point, in order to help connect people who can perform CPR or use a defibrillator, to connect them to people who may have an accident or may have a heart attack. So using open data, an open feed from 999, if you will, our 911 in the U.S., they are able to geolocate where someone is having a heart attack and the location of somebody nearby who may have cardiopulmonary resuscitation experience, who may be a trained lifesaver. So what happens as a result? Here is California, the area that San Ramon covers, and the dots reflect the number of police and fire and ambulance, the typical government services that come to your aid when you have a heart attack. When you combine that with the ability to target a single skill, the ability to perform CPR among citizens, the coverage looks like this. 7,000 lives have been saved using this service over the last 3 years, and now 4 months ago, London has started something similar called the Good Sam service. Good Samaritan service is initially beginning by registering nurses and doctors and ambulance drivers. In other words, the off-duty people who may be in this room who could help in the event of an accident. And now they're moving on to register you and me and those of us with CPR training to the end of, again, increasing our ability to save lives in accidents. So if you take away nothing else from my presentation and do nothing else after you leave today, I would encourage you, please, to sign up for this. What's enabling a project like Good Sam or Pulse Point is the fact that we now have technology that is allowing us to show and others to find the expertise that we have. Right? So you can think of something as simple as the idea of a LinkedIn. And I bet if I asked you today, actually, let me ask you, how many people here have a LinkedIn profile? There is almost not a hand, so how do I put this? No, almost very few hands have not gone up. Let me say that again. It is practically universal, the fact that it is now expected that we will make our credentials more digital and more searchable. But there are new indicia of the things that we know and can do that go beyond the diplomas that we can cite to on LinkedIn. Right now, I can take a course online. Every night, my son and I study Spanish on the free Duolingo app. And after a little while, Duolingo gives me a badge. I have received a badge now that I am 4% fluent in Spanish. I have particularly completed the units on flirting and useful words for Christmas. So I can now get a date on Christmas Eve, I suppose. It's 4%. But in any case, I get a digital badge, which I could put on my website or on my LinkedIn profile and allow you to find me should you be looking for somebody who knows how to ask for a date on Christmas Eve. If I'm a coder, this is a very familiar concept, right? I can create the code that I make. I put up that on the repository of my code on GitHub. And then you can search for the people, not who have a degree in computer science, but you can actually look at what they've done and what they've created, and thereby find people. And if you're Google, for example, 14% of the people who work in Google globally don't have a degree. They don't have a university diploma, but they do have a GitHub profile where a manager can go and search for what they know. And very often, what we know is often what we care about. So Panos Ipirotis is a scholar who does work that actually showcases and demonstrates empirical that people who care about it and are passionate about a topic, take, for example, a family member or a patient of a person with a particular disease, has a lot of deep knowledge and expertise that's independent of having to go to university and get a medical degree. I'm sure any one of you in the room have this familiarity, either from yourselves or from a loved one who has a condition. You know a heck of a lot more about managing that condition and living with it, often than the doctors who treat you. The question, though, is how we take this know-how, which is increasingly becoming more liquid, more diverse, more visible, and more searchable, and apply it to making public institutions better. And that's the question that I put to you today and that I hope we can talk about. What are the practical strategies for doing that? Over the last few years, both in the U.S. and the U.K., we have had a momentum and a movement, if you will, to use technology to make government better in terms of data, right? So the U.K. and the U.S. and 65 other countries have stood up data portals where they're now putting up data sets. You can see about what your civil servants make. Or if you are in the U.S., there are about 250,000 different data sets that are online, and this is states and localities and counties and all over. We're making data available. And with that open data, we can govern more accountably, we can spot fraud, waste, and abuse, we can put out the data such as the bus timetable or the subway timetable, allowing people to make apps that tell you when your bus is coming, right? It improves our quality of life, it allows us to make better choices. There are lots of great things that we can do thanks to this movement around open data and the desire to bring better data into how we govern. We're just at the beginning of this movement around transparency, right? This is the three values which both Obama and Cameron have articulated as being at the root of how we're going to modernize government. Transparency is one part of it. But part of that agenda that was declared on the president's first day in office and the prime minister's first week in office is that we're going to create institutions that are also more participatory and collaborative. The question, though, is why haven't we? Why do we have the great experiments around open data? So this is, let me explain this picture. I just find this picture so pretty. It's a picture of dessert from one of my favorite restaurants in Chicago. And why do I put this up there? I put this up there because we open up the data in Chicago about which restaurants lead to foodborne illness. So where you're going and getting sick, right? And Chicago turns around and uses that to create a new way of inspecting restaurants. So instead of going down the list, A, B, C, D, E, and then examining one restaurant in turn, using the data about where you or I might get sick, it's not at that pretty restaurant, they can create an algorithm to prioritize how they do their inspections, doing a better job and a faster job with dramatic results now in terms of reducing foodborne illness. So lots of success stories about data, but not as many success stories like that of Good Sam. And the question I have is, why not? Why does government, the relationship between government and citizens, not look dramatically different, even after 25 years of the World Wide Web, and even after 5 years of an open government revolution? Why can we not do more for our country using technology now than we could have 5 or 10 years ago? So we can. And we are making some advances. We are getting better at asking people how they feel, right, for their opinion. You pioneered over here a platform called ePetitions to ask people to give proposals for things that they care about, right? And we have a version of this in the U.S. called We the People that we copied from you, which is where people post their demands of government. In the U.S., you may know the most popular one of these petitions, of course, has been their two most popular petitions. Number second most popular petition, the White House should build a Death Star. First most popular petition, I'm wondering if people know. Sorry? No? Deport Justin Bieber back to Canada. This, don't ask me why, merited 100,000 signatures, captivated the public imagination. We can't get movement on gun control, but we can deport Justin Bieber back to Canada. The point is, this is a fairly anemic, look, it's a great way to bring to the public imagination, to the fore, to media attention, and to the attention of central government things that people care about in ways that ordinary people care about that might have been harder to do before. But it doesn't really make the job of the civil servant any easier. It doesn't lead to the implementation of these policies. We have not deported Justin Bieber back to Canada, nor have we built a Death Star, because these are naked suggestions without the know-how about how to make them real. But we are using technology now in ways that allow us at least to get more know-how from people and to get more, you know, boots-on-the-ground help. So in São Paulo, recognizing that in Brazil's largest city, the government doesn't have a monopoly on all the good ideas and, in fact, is behind in terms of innovation and IT capacity, the civil service turned to citizens to say, teach us. Instead of using the usual civil service training college, we're going to set up an open teaching academy called São Paulo Aberta. And they now have 24,000 civil servants taking courses from citizens who are teaching them how to be more tech savvy. Right? It's tapping into that know-how where it exists. It's getting at people's ideas, not just their feelings. So if I go online now in Madrid or in Paris, I can share an idea with the mayor, or I can tell Madrid how to craft its transparency law better. It's asking me for actual granular hard advice. know-how-based engagement, if you will, really much more scientific or technical or hard know-how, not just, again, not just opinions and feelings. I got my start doing some of this work, or the best-known project that I did some time ago was about a decade ago. I worked on a project called Peer to Patent, which was designed to help get volunteer scientists and technologists to supply scientific information to the National Patent Office to help the patent examiner make a better decision about when he or she was evaluating an application for a patent. A patent means 20 years of monopoly rights, transforms an industry potentially, and yet the bureaucrat at the other end has only 15 hours to do the research and make the decision. So why not turn to technology to actually ask people who are in science and industry to help evaluate those applications? We were asking people to do hard things. Fast forward, and 5 years ago, the federal government in the United States creates a platform inspired by the Longitude Prize in Britain from yesteryear, from 200 years ago, and stands up a platform called challenge.gov. Asking people, backed by the incentive of a prize, to help with solving hard public problems, like removing the salt from salt water to improve farming in the developing world, reducing the word gap between the number of words a rich and a poor child hears before the time he or she is five, which significantly impacts educational and healthcare and other outcomes in one's life. And again, this idea cross-fertilizes back across the pond, and now this month the European Food Safety Agency, beleaguered by criticisms of its GMO cereals decisions and other scientific decisions made, frankly, behind closed doors, says we're now going to figure out how to crowdsource more expertise. We're going to figure out how to do this in a more distributed fashion, and they're asking for help doing so, and just the tender just closed probably a week or two ago, to ask how they should go about doing this. Here's where we're stuck, though. We're stuck with the fact that this innovation is happening, challenge.gov and innovation fellowships and crowdsourced food safety. It's happening at the edges. Why? And that's the central conundrum I think we still have to unpack. And I would put to you, it is the problem of the open call. It's the problem that when I say, hello, is anyone out there that can help me remove the salt from salt water, nobody knows about it. Let me ask you in this room, how many people have been on challenge.gov? One hand in the room. One hand in the room. And this room, I would venture to say, is probably full of bright people and people with know-how and wisdom and life experience. Maybe you don't know about salt, water, and farming, but there are 450 different challenges up there that probably you know something better about how to solve than the person who posted the question. Dr. Mark Wilson, who's the father of Good Sam, a brain surgeon here at Imperial and St. Mary's Hospital in London, puts it in a way that I think is very concrete. I'm not sure why he talks about the spider, but I quite love this analogy. You're never more than 5 meters from a spider. Look to your left, look to your right. And you're similarly not more than 5 meters from somebody who knows CPR. And it's just really hard to find and mobilize that talent. It's hard to find the needle in the haystack. Partly, it's culturally difficult, because in government especially, we're not used to saying we don't know, and we're not used to asking the question, to saying, I need help with doing something. We don't have the custom, as is familiar to people who work in computer software or in other areas, of going to a question and answer site like Stack Exchange and posting a question. What is the line of code that will help my program to work? There's no shame in that if you're a programmer. In fact, it's widely accepted, and there are millions of people who use sites like this to get through the day and get their job done. We're not very good at asking questions because we view it as embarrassing, right? We're afraid we'll appear on the Daily Mail or the Telegraph the next day if, God forbid, we say we don't know. We also don't have the custom of using the tools or platforms that help us to get expertise in an agile and quick fashion. The typical way we get expertise, right, is by standing up these scientific advisory bodies. In the United States, we call them federal advisory committees. We have 1,000 of them. They have 65,000 people who serve on them. But these are committees of 10 people who meet 3 times a year in Washington, and then they write a really long 100-page PDF that nobody reads. It is not the same thing as posting a question and getting an answer in 3 minutes online. And so we need to think about it in the discussion, and as I hope we can dig in a little bit more to the mechanics of how we can move from the world of the open call, which has its place, anyone out there with a good idea, we need to invite all comers, to being able to do a little bit better job of thinking about how to use technology to target the people who might have know-how that we know we need. To target the people with the CPR expertise when we're trying to save a life, to target the people with computer science training or education when we want to teach kids how to code, to target the people who may have lived in Brazil or dealt with a pandemic or know something about mosquitoes when we're trying to deal with the Zika virus. There is no bigger opportunity than the one we have today to think about how to get better expertise into governing. And that expertise, let me be very clear, is both about credentialed know-how, but it's also about lived experience. It's the person who started a business who can help the person who wants to start a business. It's the person, though, who has a PhD in computer science and cybersecurity who can help with managing a cybersecurity attack. It's the creative people in the arts who have interesting new ideas about how to do things that may come from unusual suspects in unusual places, but that can help us to get diverse know-how to manage our challenges. Data and technology is part of that solution. And this has been named, some people call this the science of people analytics. That's a very MOD kind of term, right? It's the people analytics department. But we can use technology to help us to better unlock both credentials and experience among civil servants and among the public. I like to nickname this and think about this as the Tinder for Government project. Why? Because it's about dating. It's about matches, matching the demand for expertise to the supply for it, which is sort of like dating, except it's not in this case for a hookup. It's to save a life or do something else, but we can at least draw a little inspiration, if not a little humor, from the notion that we can get better at doing this. There is some momentum in this direction, and there are places in which public institutions, like our Ministry of Health and our Department of Health and Human Services in the United States, is one example of a place that's starting to do this. They're just starting, and I don't want to give you the sense this is finished. It's just getting off the ground. Our Food and Drug Administration is responsible for examining the safety of medical devices, right? To decide whether this thing should be sold on the marketplace. If I'm too slow at examining it, you, the entrepreneur, loses millions of dollars. If I'm too quick and too shoddy in how I examine it, you, the patient, die when this gets brought into the operating room. Sorry, that was a little. I wasn't pointing at you. I was just gesturing at you. So what are they doing? Building a platform to understand where the biomedical know-how is within the ministry so they can source the right expertise across 110,000 people and do a faster job of creating teams to examine medical devices. The proof will be in the pudding about whether they can do a better and faster job and save more lives and create more economic value. But right now, they are struggling even to staff basic teams. There are lots of examples of platforms that are out there to target not simply credentialed know-how, but also experience. So at the World Bank this past year, they've stood up a platform called Skill Finder to index the skills and experience of 27,000 employees and civil servants and consultants who work there. And to go with it, just last month, they created a help desk. So that if you need to know who out there has experience with building a well in Burkina Faso, you can use the platform, or in this case, call the help desk, and they will help to use the platform and broker the right expertise for you so you can find someone else who's done it. Again, the question is, will it lead to the reduction in global poverty, the goal of the bank? And that is what I hope will be the outcome. But we will find out in the next few years. At the very least, both Cameron and Obama have both talked about, you know, it's tapping into the talent of the civil service, and I think thinking about ways of using technology for how we do that is important. I've only had time to talk about a couple of these examples, but a quick plug for the fact that we've posted a number of these examples online under Smarter State if you're interested in more ways in which public institutions are beginning to use technology, particularly to learn from one another. Let me close by saying that the next step is to use this to truly invigorate participatory democracy, right? Targeting the credentials and ability of citizens. So if it's a growing platform like AgriVivo, which indexes the skills and ability of agricultural scientists around the world, or if it's a platform that goes after experience like the Good Sam or Pulse Point example, or like what's Podemos, the upstart political party in Spain that now controls the mayoralty in Barcelona and Madrid, is building a platform. They have, it's already up, called Banco de Talentos, where they're trying to figure out, how do we tap into the skills of the people who are part of our movement? And how do we use that to better organize the delivery of services? In Wales, there is a small borough, well, you would know better than I. Anyone from here by any chance? Anybody from Torfaen? Even fewer hands than went up for challenge.gov. So they have built a platform called Wisdom Bank. Why Wisdom Bank? Because they have a lot of people over 60 who have life experience, and they have a lot of unemployed teenagers, youth, a high number. They also have a lot of patients with diabetes and Alzheimer's, and a lot of people who want to know how to manage those conditions. They're thinking about how, at a local level, we connect that tacit knowledge, we make it more manifest and usable by citizens, not to the end of removing government from the picture, but to the end of actually helping people to solve problems faster and re-envisioning government's role as a broker of that conversation. So there's a lot we have to do to actually get from here to there, to build what Susan Moffat calls a participatory bureaucracy, right? More participatory governing, not just elections. We need to embrace the idea, of course, that citizens are smart and that expertise is widely distributed. We have to think about legal frameworks to enable it. In the U.S., we actually have to get rid of some laws that actively make this impossible. And here we have to think about, how do we create the laws that make this more the norm? We also need to have better technology that actually makes these skills and talents searchable. So this is the movement that many people call the badging movement, right? So the little digital symbol I get from Duolingo with about my 4% fluency in Spanish is a badge. And if I go to NYU's School of Public Professional Service, I get a digital badge when I take a course, right? And there is a movement around creating these new systems of badges and also identifying which badges indicate which credentials people have. That has become a very popular question now that companies like LinkedIn and foundations like Lumina and Markle are investing in and doing experiments in places like Manchester and in Colorado to figure out how to do more of this. Not to the end, incidentally, of how to match people with skills to opportunities to do public service, but to figure out how to match people with skills to jobs and available economic opportunity. But the same infrastructure that we're building to accelerate the ability to match jobs and job seekers, we can also think about using to help serve the public interest as well as the private interest. Private sector employers are very interested in this and will be in, and are investing in this space because they recognize that merely the fact that you carry a credential, the proxy of expertise, a fancy diploma from a fancy institution in England, does not mean you have any skills, right? And they want to know, what can you actually do to minimize turnover and improve outcomes in business? And again, we have to think about how to do that for the public sector. So let me close by saying there is more we have to do, right? We need new tools that are actually designed for public purposes. This is some work that we've been pioneering in helping public officials to think about across 8 countries to explore and make visual what their innovation skills are. And we need to run more experiments. Because what I submit to you today is that this is something we have to test. I don't have all the answers. I don't know that it will work. But I do know that we have to see whether targeting what people know and can do, which is what they're doing in health and human services around medical devices, versus what they're doing in the environment ministry in the U.S. to post projects and say who across the ministry can help with the project, we need to compare which of these innovations is the best way to unlock talent that we have. That means for us as as institutions, there's a lot we need to do. But for us as individuals, we also have to commit, to the extent to which we're comfortable and it suits our vision of privacy, to put ourselves out there, to say, I have CPR knowledge, and I'm willing to let you tap into it. This is not a nice to have. This is not about participatory democracy because it builds legitimacy, which by itself should be enough of a reason. But in the tough economic times that we face, with the hard challenges that we struggle with, it's not enough. I would argue that this is really about more effective governing, better services, better policies, and better outcomes. In that sense, I don't know if you know these two American philosophers. They are progenitors for Habermas, so Walter Lippmann on the right and John Dewey on the left. Dewey was the one who truly believed that citizens were smart and that they had great expertise and that it was important to tap into their knowledge. Lippmann, with whom he was in constant debate in the 1920s, Lippmann was of the view that we needed that stronger technocracy. We needed better expertise into government. It wasn't more about educating citizens. It was more about educating government. We needed to get that, the bureaucrats needed to get smarter. I'm putting the two of them together because I think citizens have that know-how. They have that supply. Government has that demand, and technology can help us to bring that gap, to build the stronger state, the smarter state, and to allow us to create a more active vision of citizenship. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Beth. A very interesting and challenging run-through. I love the idea of a Tinder for government, although I'm a bit scared of it. There are so many things to cover there. It's interesting to think about the culture that is needed to support this kind of transformation. You talked about being on the edge of a movement for open data, and that this was still in its nascent state rather than actually really having been landed, if you like, in current practice. I'm interested in trying to understand a little bit about how we make these customs, you know, how this becomes how we actually live when you talk about things like Good Sam and the challenge prizes. How do we actually need to engage with the citizen differently to make these things become the mechanics actually work so that they get to the wider populace?
So I think the first point is that we need to do more of it. The proof is always in the pudding, right? So it's Good Sam and supporting things like that are the best way to move this forward because it shows us what works. So the notion I would not put to you, in fact, I would be actively opposed to the notion that a government ministry should go out and spend tens of millions of pounds on some sort of people analytics platform to understand the skill set of every single employee in the place without a vision for what you're going to do with that. So that's a little bit the challenge the World Bank faced. They did exactly that. They've spent a lot of money on a knowledge management system, but they didn't have a way to connect it initially to the problems of global poverty. They had an idea about why they wanted to use it, but it didn't really prove itself. So that's when they stood up the help desk to realize, what we're really trying to do is to help people find other people with experience so we can become more effective in the field. So first of all, to the extent to which what the goal is to demonstrate that co-production, collaborative problem solving, more collaboration between institutions and citizens works, that's where challenge.gov, innovation fellowships, whatnot, these have helped to prime the pump. They've essentially helped to show what's possible and that it is plausible to do this. And then we just have to take the next step of becoming a little bit more systematic in how we do this. So that's where Good Sam or Pulse Point, taking one skill, CPR, and seeing if we can't scale that up in a dramatic way so that everybody is activated as a citizen first responder. And we have to look for those sort of high-value places where we can do that. Maybe it's around, again, tapping into those with computer science or innovation training or small business owners. We have to find the pockets and then look at how we accelerate the process of matching, whether it's government to citizens or citizens to citizens in many cases, in order to demonstrate, in order to see whether it leads to better outcomes. And that's where the Nudge Unit and David Halpern and his work in the UK here have been very instrumental at least teaching us a degree of humility to say, we should try it, and we should measure what works, and we should have results, and then we should think about how to scale things like this. So to your point, I think the way we build institutional readiness is by doing it and proving that it works.
So it's interesting because there is a reliance on the active citizen there. It'd be interesting, as you have worked in the US and in the UK, if you've seen any notable differences in the nature of active citizenship.
A friend once said to me the big difference in the US and the UK is that in the UK everything is old and in the US everything is big. I think that sums it up. So, but in terms of political culture, I think there are ways in which, let me see what I should say without getting myself in trouble here. There has been a lot of cross-fertilization in this area of government innovation and government modernization between both places. So you pioneered the e-petitions platform, and then we copied it. You created the Longitude Prize a long time ago, and we copied it in the form of challenge prizes. But we've had a little more success, for example, of backing that with legislation, which actually makes it easy for a government ministry to post a challenge prize. But in turn, you've done more work at sort of measuring what works in terms of these prizes. So I think there's been a very healthy dialogue around these topics. We have, frankly, the over-legalization of work in the United States, our hyper-concern with probity, not always to great success, our hyper-concern with fairness, which leads to, for example, very strict rules around procurement or very strict rules about who's allowed to come into government, have actually produced some innovations in the sense that the difficulties of procuring new technology and innovation led to the creation of challenge.gov, which is essentially an end run around procurement. It doesn't touch procurement law. So you give a prize under a different legal authority, and that allows you to buy lots of innovation, essentially, without having to worry about the slowdowns of procurement. The difficulties of getting people into government from the private sector led to the creation of innovation fellowships and other vehicles. I went into government on a special kind of vehicle that makes it easier for people from a university or a nonprofit to go into government. So there's ways in which hardship has allowed us to innovate in some places. And I think in turn, there's a lot of interest here in looking at how to bring more fellows into government. So I know you were hoping for some smoking gun or some great criticism, which I won't oblige, because I think there's been a very healthy kind of dialogue on these topics. And I've been lucky to be part of some of those conversations on both sides of the pond.
No, it's very clear that there has been quite a lot of knowledge transfer that's been fostered between the UK and the US in this way.
We have a government digital service because you have a government digital service. And then, you know, and it's called exactly the same thing. And now we have a nudge unit because you have a nudge unit. So you will be happy to know that in many of these instances, you know, England is, in fact, Britain is the model, which the US is copying, but we make it bigger. Mm. We just do it bigger.
Someone should tweet that. That's quite a good recommendation for the UK.
Size matters. Tinder for government. Yes. Size matters.
No, I mean...
That'll be the takeaway line.
No, that's good. That's good. I mean, on that Tinder for government, you talked a lot about searching credentials, and that we were beginning to. There was a lot of matchmaking in your presentation,
yes.
And it's quite interesting. The knowledge management is becoming a lot easier and a lot more open sourced. The finding the credentials, finding the experience, and targeting credentials of citizens or, as you say, people who could move into government who have broader skills than the traditional skill set mm-hmm. that you might be looking for. But to take that dating analogy a little bit further, you need to engender sort of social skills needed to work in this way yeah. as well. And do you feel that culture is as advanced, if you like, as technology in being able to handle the...
I think the question is spot on. The technology is the easy part. And culturally... the deficits are both on the institutional side and on the side of civil society as well. So we have become so accustomed to this kind of aggressive critique of government, this stance where our job is to critique government, our job is to elect the bums and then throw them out, as they say. But the culture, which is that of co-production and co-creation and collaboration, is a much less well-developed kind of instinct. And so that also has to do with media culture and headline-grabbing culture. But there haven't been the way... we haven't had the experience with engagement. It has not been cheap enough to create lots of different forms of engagement, so most of us don't engage, right? We vote. Maybe we comment on some kind of a commenting process, or we comment on it, we sign a petition. But the notion that this implies, which is lots and lots and lots of different ways of engaging... essentially scaling up. Many people do a lot of voluntaristic activity, but connecting that back to institutions, still not very well developed. When I worked on a project that we at that time nicknamed experts.gov when I was in the White House, the challenge that we faced was not the lack of a platform. We had lots of choices, most of which were free. The challenge was getting anybody willing to ask a question in a fractured political environment with fighting political parties, the willingness of somebody to say, I don't know, was what killed the project, frankly. And so now that project has moved out to the ministries and to the civil service, where people are less afraid of and are frankly quite willing to say, we don't know how to examine medical devices fast enough and well enough. Everybody knows that there's a problem, and so there's an opportunity to solve it. So it's not well developed on the institutional side, and also on the citizen side, we don't have enough experience because there isn't a way for us to get that experience right now.
Mm-hmm. It's the institutional risk aversion, which needs to be broken down, but also that active citizenship, yeah, which needs to be grown, if you
like. Which is why we need to show that it works in the first place. Mm-hmm. Which is why if the way to engage is Good Sam and you can save a life, the feedback loop that that creates to suggest we should do more of that and we should do more of it in other spaces, I think becomes pretty powerful.
Absolutely. Okay, so I will take some questions from the audience.
Thank you. To me, this sounds like there's sort of a transactional arrangement going on between citizens and governments. And isn't one of the barriers the fact that people think they're already paying for a service? Mm. All those guys out there, I'm paying my taxes or whatever to the council or the government. So what am I going to get back against something that I've already paid for? Why aren't they just doing it? And so the model that I sort of provoke the debate with is, if you go to the commercial world, loyalty cards, mm-hmm, being good examples, where you get a direct transactional, what's the benefit back for me? What do I get back for what I'm about to give you, whether it's my data, my service, or something? The nudge process would actually drive engagement, mm, and some sort of transaction, because there's a transaction. I don't give away something for nothing, particularly if I think I've already paid for it.
Okay. Do you want to address that one straight off?
As you like. So it's a fabulous question. And, you know, this question about also the line between, well, let me say, I think there's a... I think the idea, or what you're pushing towards, which is potentially more forms of recognition. You know, the loyalty card, you get the discount on your bananas or whatever it is that you get for giving away your data, if that's worth it. So one, you know, engagement here has a potentially lot of payback for you. One is obviously if you save someone's life, I would like to think that's payback in and of itself that people are willing to do. The notion that you might get a credential or a distinction or an honor that you are part of you did something and you could use that as a professional credential that you put on your CV that you are a citizen first responder for Good Sam, that has professional benefits for people. If you look, for example, at the Stack Exchange question and answer platform, widely used among technologists, but also has fora for gardening and photography and such things, why do people go on there to answer other people's questions? Why do they do it? They do it, and what is the business model for the company that runs it? They don't charge for the asking of questions or answers. What they do is they give you points. They give you badges. They show that you can demonstrate that you have answered 42 questions about C++, and you can in turn use that badge to go out and get a job with that. And so they actually make their money with a job marketplace where those credentials become very valuable. So you can imagine there are instances of co-production or co-creation where there actually may be a professional advancement. There may be areas in which money may actually be involved, like a challenge.gov kind of setting where there's a prize back challenge and there's actually remuneration. There might be an opportunity to stick your head above the parapet as a way to get a consulting opportunity. But I'd also like to think that a lot of this is not quite so transactional. So the other side of this is there are many places in which this is simply about asking you, inviting people to serve in ways that speak better to their skills, abilities, and interests. And there are many people, you know, look at Wikipedia, look at Good Sam, people are willing to volunteer and help so long as it speaks to what they care about and what they can do quickly and won't take too long as a way to do. So that's where Peter Patton was a great example, is the thing that would take a patent examiner 15 hours was 10 minutes for somebody who knew about that particular industry or that particular science and worked in industry. Right, so if you can do something good and do it for 10 minutes, and by the way, if we can also recognize your service, it seems like a pretty good idea. And if it also comes with professional advancement or maybe some chances of making some money, and it makes things worse better and reduces the cost of delivering service and reduces those taxes, so lots of possibilities for how to think about incentives essentially around such a system.
It's clearly beneficial to get CPR to people having heart attacks. But the question is, the distance between that and the mega project. And what's not talked about is issues of politics and power. There's a lot of popular imagination and energy, which is basically subversive, and this is an attempt to domesticate. You talk about, in one of your slides, about the key objectives of Obama and Cameron, transparency, participation. But I look at transparency and then I think about TPP and TTIP, which is exactly the opposite of transparency. I think about participation and I think about the current government's attacks on charities who attempt to engage different participatory energy in ways the government doesn't find comfortable or convenient. And so there's this whole question about who sets up the decision space for where these projects happen. Because if you control the decision space, then it doesn't matter what people say. But we have to open up who can say what questions are being asked.
Thank you.
Thank you. You're going to think you're in a very transactional room, but I just wanted to go back to the to something connected to the first question, which is that I think that I completely agree with the idea of making the most of expertise and know-how and actually trusting your citizens to contribute to public institutions in this way. But we're not just saying, therefore, that, or people might not just therefore think that they've already paid for it. They might also think that these institutions already exist. And so what we're actually asking them to do is to create and contribute to new institutions, which is great. But I wonder whether, to follow up on your response to the first question, is there a way that potentially some of the rewards could be linked for citizens to a basic citizen's income? Is this, you know, might there not be a link here where we might say, well, actually, you know, this is what we're asking of you as new citizens, and these are the new rewards of citizenship. It has a dramatic impact potentially on employment and remuneration. Isn't this the link to justify a citizen's income?
Okay, two interesting, intelligent questions. New types of rewards and the issues of politics and power. Who sets up the decision space for how right. The questions are set?
Let me work backwards. That which was, I think, was a suggestion more than, rather than a question. And I love the idea of creative thinking about policies and ideas that would actually create more incentives for people to engage and participate, recognize and reward that engagement, beyond just the satisfaction that comes from engaging. I'm thinking, as you're talking, of course, now about the wider diffusion of the new innovation, not just of the last few years, called participatory budgeting. Primarily at the local level, in use about 1,500 communities around the world, grew up out of Brazil, but now all over the world, which is essentially taking a chunk of the budget and in giving citizens, giving back to citizens, frankly, the right to spend that money. Not the usual decision makers, not the usual people who control the decision making, but giving that power to citizens to control how that spending actually happens, which in many ways is a reward because you're determining which services are going to be delivered, what gets done with that money. But it's interesting to think about what that would mean in terms of if you were doing a kind of civil service, essentially, like a military service, essentially, whether there are ways of tying some remuneration to that or whatnot. So I think it's a fabulous suggestion, and I think worth fleshing out further what the different ideas are about in the context in which what are the appropriate mechanisms, incentives, and rewards. The point about politics and power, it's why I preface this talk by saying first that I have no answers to the problem of elections, which also require a great deal of attention to fixing the problems of politics and partisanship and money in politics that we suffer from, particularly in the United States. Here's why I think this, but I don't want to be naive to suggest that there aren't, for example, many decisions that are made on the basis of values or politics that fly in the face of any kind of expertise or evidence, right? So how does any of this help with that? I think in two ways. One is when you start to think about mechanisms for getting in more expertise in a more open fashion, it at least becomes more difficult. You have to own up to the fact that you are making decisions that reject the expertise that you're getting. So when we currently get expertise in these small committees that essentially work behind closed doors, and even though there may be minutes, you know, it's a PDF that sits on a government website that nobody has ever taken a look at, right? It's effectively a closed-door process. Instead of thinking about how do I create networks of people that can help on a particular policy. That can have, I think, a profound effect on the transparency and the accountability of the decisions that actually get made, and can hopefully, at the very least, to bring more evidence and expertise into how we make decisions. It is not fully an answer to the fact that, in the end of the day, people will make decisions regardless of the evidence and regardless of the data, but at least can bring a little more accountability to that. And I'll just give you one example. Right now, in the Ministry of Education in the United States, if you take the problem of funding and financing for higher education, a very vexing problem for us, particularly given the cost of higher education and the increasing social disparity in the ability to afford that education, the increasing debt load of students in our country. The people tasked with advising the ministry on that question are 11 people on a committee that, because of the technicalities and difficulties involved in standing up these committees, has been around since 1986 and has social representation on it, one student, one university president, one this, one that, a kind of tokenism. But imagine you replace, and then the ministry goes off and does whatever it wants on these topics, right? But imagine the idea that I could get thousands and thousands of people who have expertise in education, whether because they teach or they learn or they build educational software or they write curricula, and I could develop a process, and I try to elaborate on this in my book at much greater length and detail how to do this. I could have a better ability to get answers to questions so that I can make decisions that are rooted in good and better ideas about how to do things, or at least I have some evidence of better ways of doing things. It might produce, again, better outcomes and more accountability in the process. But I do not say any of this. I say this fully conscious of power and politics and as a way of coming at it through the back door by bringing more citizen expertise into the process.
Okay, thank you.
In terms of government officials taking advice more broadly, I mean, conventionally the system is that they will take advice from people from accredited institutions, and that provides some form of assurance. How, through some of the models that you're suggesting and looking at, is that assurance still there, that so-called experts are actually giving solid advice?
Right. The sort of paradigm that you set up seems to be rather one-way traffic. Maybe it should be smarter citizens in a smarter state. And I'm sort of, bear in mind here that in the UK, we have a very powerful executive branch. We are the most centralised country in Europe, and we're relatively secretive. And the way I've seen data being used within the public sector is to enable the government to centralise further. I think maybe there needs to be a contract that the data goes the other way, so that when the government asks, for instance, for ideas, it actually sets out what it rejects as ideas so people can see what it has done. And when people provide data to government, that the government provides the data back afterwards. But it seems to me that we need to have a sort of charter for two-way traffic.
Thank you. The models of engagement that you describe very much focus on the contribution that citizens can make to government and decision-making as experts. But there are many other models of engagement that focus on citizens as adding value because they're not experts, or in some way they represent public views and lay concerns and voices. So, for example, you might look at the fact that many members of the public might have certain views about genetic editing or about nanotechnology. My question to you is there a tension between those two strands of thought? So the citizen as expert versus the citizen as lay person or as representative of lay values? And if so, how can we navigate that when we're making the case for citizens' voice in relation to decisions about public policy or decisions that government might be making?
My goodness, I cannot do justice to these questions, which one more profound than the next. So I will fail miserably, but briefly now. And working backwards, and this picks up on some of the threads we've heard before. So I take this in a way as the comment about sort of values versus, let me call it values versus know-how. So I want to say that none of this is to replace asking people for their views or asking people how they feel. Processes that I think are better developed and we can do, but we can still do more of and a better job. But that's a very different thing than like in the peer-to-patent process when you ask for layperson advice about a patent application. It's not asking people how they feel about the patent. It's not asking people at IBM whether they like Microsoft's patent application or not. The process is designed in a highly structured way to solicit and elicit very specific kinds of know-how that's needed to examine that application. And therefore, you can be self-interested, you can be from IBM and hate Microsoft, or you can have a particular view one way or the other, but it's a specific kind, it's a context in which a specific kind of factual information is needed in order to make a better decision. I am taking the lower hanging fruit to start with of areas that are, let's say, less value driven, because I think it will help us to build and flex the muscle of engagement and participation. Your opinion about CPR and defibrillators is somewhat less relevant to the can you operate the defibrillator and save the life. So it's a case in which it's an easier case conceptually than what is my view of abortion or what is my view of gay marriage or what is my view of genetic editing or whatever the topic may be. So I choose that intentionally. You may view this as the I'm being wimpy or in some way, but in fact, I think it's about helping to build those practices. Similarly, in transparency is a very poor word and never should have been used because very little of what either government has done has been about what we've traditionally thought of as transparency. The open data movement has been about, making data about, farmers markets and infection rates in hospitals and the safety of bridges more visible, not the data about how government spends money and operates. To the extent of solving problems. Why? It's a lower-hanging fruit way of beginning to create the ability for people to become more open and create the ability to collaborate. Anyway, now, so I have not been brief. It's just these questions are so interesting. Let me try to just quickly tackle some of the other things that were mentioned here, which I'm going to forget. So the centralization of data and the one-way traffic, and this gets back to who controls the decision-making. I should have said at the outset, number one, all of these processes are not just about how do I get input at the very end when I'm trying to implement a policy. This can also be used for getting expertise to allow us to set the agenda, to ask the questions and control the agenda. And ultimately, that's the direction you actually want to get to. So a participatory budgeting is about letting people decide how money gets spent. This idea about developing networks of people with subject matter expertise is about identifying the problems, not just coming up with the solutions. But I think we're not doing a great job of doing either one of these right now. And if the first thing I can accomplish is to get agreement to do stuff at the end of that tail of getting data in to help the existing people make a decision, if that helps to start to build the practice, peer-to-patent was that. The patent office continued to control the decision-making. But if we hadn't done that, we never would have gotten challenge.gov because nobody would have believed it was possible to do that. And if we hadn't done challenge.gov, we wouldn't have gotten innovation fellowship. So this is also about how do we, in practical reality, actually change, re-engineer the plane while we're flying it. And the taking it, how do we keep assurance, how do we create assurance in the process? So Good Sam, to take that, come back to this example, they started by only taking doctors and nurses. You had to have an ID card and you had to scan it and you had to upload it because they did not want me performing CPR on you. Not because there's a legal problem with it, I'm absolved of liability if I accidentally kill you in the process, but because they thought it would work a lot better to have some assurances. So in the cases where that is appropriate, obviously you can have people show their credentials, but the point is that expertise can go very much beyond credentials. It can be about know-how. And I'll give you a quick final example on this score. Talking yesterday to the folks who do the hospital audits here on the quality of care in a variety of areas. So they provide the league tables on strokes and hip replacements and cataracts and do these kind of 100-page studies with data about how hospitals compare. But the challenge is how do you turn those 100-page studies into 10 recommendations for what a hospital should do differently. I can give you the data about hospital infection rates, but what should I do about it as somebody who runs a hospital or as a patient or as a doctor? The answer is a person with a medical degree is not always in the best position to answer that question about what you should do. I might want somebody who actually is an architect who knows something about how buildings are designed, or a psychologist. So, in other words, expertise is very diverse. So I just don't want us to get stuck in the old rut of saying same old people who went to, you know, Harvard and MIT and Oxford and Cambridge, and that those are the only people we talk to, because experience is much broader than that.
Thank you. Well, we are sadly out of time. Thank you for a fascinating run through deliberative democracy and the limitations of petitions in the digital age, and how we all will become activated as smart and engaged citizens. Beth's book, Smart Citizens, Smart State, is outside, and I'm sure there will be signed copies available. But please join me now in thanking Beth Simone Novak.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed this podcast, why not download our free app to access video and audio files on the go? Just visit our website, therSA.org, and follow the links to the RSA Vision mobile app.